Grizzle Pod, episode 22. What is up, everybody? Scott Willis, Tom George, Grizzle. What's going down, Scott?
Not much, man. How you feeling this week?
Yeah, good, man. Good. It's getting back to the swing of life from post LA. It's good.
It was La La Land in a good way out there.
Yeah, no, it was really nice. It's beautiful out there. And we got some projects, ideas, lots coming out of LA. So stay tuned. Grizzle's going worldwide, or at least North America. Yeah,
that's the plan.
Yeah. Scott, we got a good episode here today. But first, let's talk about our sponsor.
Y-Charts. If you guys have been listening to the pod, you know Y-Charts. We use them for our fundamental analysis, our charting, the whole thing. Y-Charts is a powerful suite, and it's a fraction of the price of your Bloomberg terminals. So we love it.
Yeah, so, you know, just today, and we're going to talk about it a little later, but, you know, how you think about fundamentals. I was like, you know what? Pinterest's down 20% in a day. I'm like, that's always a good time to pick something up. But then you kind of have to go to valuation to figure out the next step. And that's how Y-Charts puts that all together in a nice, easy-to-use just way to just slam it out real quick and bang, bang. And then I didn't pull the trigger, Scott, just because it wasn't right. Anyways, we'll talk about it
more. Yeah, we'll talk more about Pinterest this later in the episode, actually.
Yeah. So let's hit them with the agenda. What do we got?
Yeah, so the main theme today is the IPO. We're talking all about IPOs and how they're starting to get disrupted. Every, you know, disruption, it starts slow, then it goes fast. We're at the slow part of the IPO disruption curve, but we're noticing some big things are happening. So we're going to take you through the changes we're seeing. And then also we got to talk about two IPOs that happened last week. Robinhood's the big one. Also Traeger, Grill Company, got to talk about them. So you're going to learn a lot about IPOs and how they're potentially changing in this episode. Yeah. And then we have some news that we got to cover as well. We're talking about Pinterest earnings. If you saw the Pinterest chart, it was down big on earnings. We're going to talk about why, if you should be buyers here. And then China was also in the news for their tech crackdown. It's been going on for a few weeks. We're going to talk about what's going on there. Is this, you know, a buying opportunity? What are they thinking? Kind of the whole thing. And lastly, we just actually, right before we were powering up the podcast, we saw something from Elon Musk. He loves to just tweet randomly. He attacked Apple. Yeah. So that's worth mentioning.
Well, yeah, I thought that was interesting and just worth talking about. Anyhow, it's
does he have to pick with Apple? We'll talk about it.
So the IPO, Scott, this is things are changing. Things are changing.
So I think it might be helpful for everyone to first talk about what an IPO is and how it's been. It's been a pretty sleepy process for 20 years. It's worked the same way all along. Tom, maybe you want to keep them through so how does an IPO work? And then we see that stocks generally perform very well on that first day of IPO versus the price pre-public. Why is that? Who wins with that?
Yeah, so just a bit of a primer, obviously, like, you know, and we talked about it last week just in terms of how the food chain works, right? Yeah, start with VC, they take big risks, and then ultimately, you know, when it's time, you know, you're getting bigger and bigger up the chain, and then ultimately the VCs then hand that off.
They want liquidity, right? Because they invested a few $100,000 and a few $1 million. They sat on that company for years, likely.
Yeah.
Now they want to be able to realize those gains because they're all on paper. An IPO is what lets them do that.
Right, exactly. And then you have institutional investors. You know, these are like the big asset managers, the Black Rocks of the world. In Canada, TD Asset Management, Royal Bank Asset Management. You got Templeton's of the world. Like, go on and on. But those guys, you know, ultimately then carry the baton. And then they participate in the equity raise here, right? So they're the ones actually purchasing the shares, right?
So they're kind of the last buyers before this stock goes public, right?
Yeah, exactly. And this is like typically an IPO is done with a raise, right? Like you just say, hey, listen, we have the world to conquer. We're getting on all the big global funds, upwards and onwards. And the process, so this is where investment bankers come in, they work it all together. The magic, if you will, for the bankers is pricing the deal correctly. Grizzle's made a hallmark, you know, this is what we do. We know when deals are priced well, i.e. there's upside still in the stock. and or when they're priced really badly. And, you know, we've kind of made a, you know, we made a that, you know, that's our calling card, really, like, you know, kings of the IPO, because, you know, we follow this stuff really closely. And, you know, Scott did a great job on Robinhood, talk about that bit later. But the key thing here is, right, like, the banker has to price the thing correctly, right, Scott? And you kind of, like, you don't want to be, like, pricing it stratospherically, because then you don't know what's going to happen, you know, post it going public, right?
And there's a danger if you get too greedy and you try to sell something that may only be worth, people really only want to pay $20, and you try to get them to pay $40. Well, maybe you get it off for $40, so it's good. Yep. But then the stock could tank after, and then it kind of tarnishes the name of the company, because perception is reality in the market. So if you see an IPO perform badly, people might think, just, oh, is there something wrong with this company? Even though it's just the price. So you got to be careful, because remember, higher stock prices actually let you raise money, buy new companies, succeed. Yeah. So it works both ways with stock prices.
Yeah, and I think we were talking about that last week, right? And I think we're like, you know, you have two choices, right? You have choice A, the company gets like max, you know, gets the max amount price that it's selling to institutional, max amount of money that comes into their coffers so they can do X, Y, Z with. Or, and then the stock, as you said, tanks, and then the stock just languishes, because it, you know, the DNA of the stock has been kind of tarnished, because you don't have a record, right? You don't have a record. You don't have this price history in your first price.
You don't have earnings where you're beating to then get the stock back on its feet. It's just kind of, it's all technicals at that point, and who owns it, who wants to sell it, who's worried about it. It's not fundamentals for a while.
Exactly. And I think the best way to really do it is that you provide, you know, some level of a pop on day one. I'm not going to prescribe it, but let's not call it 30 or 40%, like some level of a pop.
I mean, it can be even bigger than that. We've seen some 100% plus pops in the last year or two.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think those are great either, right, Scott? Like, no. I think what you want is just like a reasonable pop, and then you kind of just continue to grind higher because your business is great and X, Y, Z. So, but then a little bit behind the scenes, how this all works, right? So the idea is a hot IPO. Everyone talks about the hot IPO. By definition, it has to be a hot IPO, Scott. Like, that's the whole process, right? If your commodity, your stock, your business isn't hot, well, you ain't IPOing. That's just the way it works, right?
Yeah, you see these guys, they usually are IPOing when their numbers look really good. Something's happened. It may not continue. It might continue. But in the example of like these grill companies, everyone was stuck at home during a pandemic. Grill sales are through the roof. That's a perfect time to IPO if you're not already public.
100%. And so, you know, the traditional process is that, you know, you get all these institutions, big players, and you also get hedge funds, Scott. So you're getting fast money plus, quote unquote, long-term holders. And I say quote unquote, because I know a lot of the institutional players that play in IPOs, because performance is so tough. These guys just have not had good track records in general. Like, you look at anything, right? Active management's just been, it's just been terrible, that, you know, they'll do anything just to get their like secured profit, if you will, Scott, right? They're not going to sit on things for a long time. So even if it's like, you know, if it aggregates to 10 basis points, 20 basis points of alpha through the year, and that's a lot of it, but that's a lot of alpha. But, if they can even get that from, let's call it like, you know, IPO flipping, they'll do it, right? And so, but that only works if there's a buyer on the other side. If there's this, if there's this.
And historically there has been, right? Because IPOs in general, whatever the price is prior to when it starts trading, it opens higher than that, more than 50-50.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there was a great graph, actually. I'll bring it on next pod. But there was a great graph showing money left on the table, which is that concept of what's the difference between what the company could have got if they just priced it correctly with the pop. And so historically, it's always been like a certain amount of money left on the table across the whole aggregate spectrum. But
which, who gets that money, right? It's money left on the table for the company, but who gets it?
Right. And it's, so that goes to institutions, right?
Like, the institutions kind of that bought in right before it went public, they get that gain. The company does not.
Exactly. And so 2020 was a massively historic year. Like, it was like three times higher than previous. Like, and basically it was the same for the last like 10, 15 years. So it kind of was like, there was a lot of money left on the table by the corporates, by the bankers not pricing it correctly, i.e. transferring share price upside to the institutions, the big mutual fund companies, et cetera, that get the
And money. What's changed here is I think for the first time, the venture capitalists are starting to speak up and maybe on behalf of the companies and saying, we don't like this pop because it means it's money we're not getting. The best IPO process for us, maybe not for these institutions that are buying at the end of the road, but for the companies, you want an IPO to not go up or down on the first day because that means it's priced perfectly. And so the company, yep. say, has sold shares for 20, it opens at 20 publicly, stays at 20. That's great. Mm-hmm. They captured all the value they could from the IPO process. So you've heard some big venture capitalists are starting to complain and say, we need a new IPO process where it's priced perfectly instead of there's 500 people that want access to this deal, only 300 get in. So then, and they do that on purpose. They could give everyone 500 people access. Then the deal pops on day one. That's not great for the company. It's got to change.
And Scott, so I think before, like, you know, obviously we're going to talk about disruption here in the IPO and talking about how retail is getting access. But I think, you know, Scott, you've done a lot of great work on the direct listing. Could you talk about that little nuance? Obviously, not little, but that's been a different way companies have come public, and it's not the typical IPO process.
Yeah, and there's only been four or five companies that have used it so far, but it seems to be gaining in popularity. What this is instead, usually in an IPO process, the banks that are on the deal, the company hires like six banks to drum up demand. They just go to their friends, their hedge funds and their institutions they know, high net worth individuals, and say, okay, here's the pricing we're thinking of. Do you like that? Does it sound good? That's how the deal is filled. But that ends up being where, because of this pop, sometimes people will buy in even if they don't really like the price because they plan to sell the first trade of the day or soon after. But again, that pop is not good for the company. So a direct listing just says the company kind of electronically on the first day says, we have all these shares. Who wants them? Submit a price and how many shares you want. Then you kind of reach an equilibrium price that way. And what's happened with these direct listings is the pop hasn't been as big. It's been a lot smaller than typical, which does mean that the companies get more value for their shares that they're selling on that first day. So it has worked out like it should.
And the companies aren't raising money. Am I right, Scott? Like they mostly direct listings, they're not raising new capital.
Yeah, so that's a good nuance. They're not in a typical IPO. They issue new shares and they get money for that.
That's right.
In the beginning, direct listings, they just were taking shares they already had and selling them from, say, the CEO would sell some of his shares to the institutional investors. That recently changed. So direct listings going forward, they can raise money. So it's going to look more like an IPO.
Oh,
yeah. Wow, the law just changed.
That's fascinating. So yeah, this is really good. Cause like, you know, we're coming in to talk about how retail is going to get new access, but also this whole direct listing thing has been pretty wild. So Scott, now we got new wrinkles here with the Robinhood IPO. And guys, Scott just crushed it. It looked at it every which way, sizzle, sizzle, short, like just like quick
fundamentals,
hot takes, but like
some jokes. Yeah. Got everything 1 minute at a time.
Exactly. And it's a fascinating company, to be totally frank. It was just like, you know, and it was the right way for me to consume it. I'm like, yeah, man, this is like, there is no company, you know, there's no company, if you are trading stocks, that is more relevant in terms of an IPO with what the storyline has been in the last 6 months. This has been a drama worthy of a movie, right? It really has.
And it's going to be in movies and books and everything. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's this whole pandemic, the rise of the retail trader, Robinhood's IPO, this is a...
Maybe just before we get into Robinhood in particular, and we're going to talk through a lot about that, I'll talk about the one other change happening to IPOs. And it's who's buying into them before they go public. Typically, it was only institutions. The way this worked is if you were a big bank or a hedge fund and you did business with a Credit Suisse or a Morgan Stanley, they would get access to the shares and they'd give you some. And so how it worked is they'd give you some because you were a good client of theirs and you'd make money off that day one pop. So that's how you kind of paid as quid pro quo. You pay them through being a client. They give you some gains on your stock portfolio. But now what it's doing is Robinhood gave access to retail investors to take down 20% of the deal. So they got pre-IPO shares. Typically, up to this point, only 1% at most of a deal went to retail investors. So this was also a historic change. And we'll see if it kind of catches on. When we talk about Robinhood, I'll give you my opinion on if I think it catches on based on how Robinhood did.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's fascinating how, you know, just this aspect of it. I think the democratization word, right? I'm not a big fan of it, because most people are just using it in a totally slanderous way. It's just been totally hacked. But I have to say this, having retail have access to this is huge, right? And that I think can be, I'd love to see more of this. It's good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So this is definitely a good thing. And hopefully, the market, basically, I think technology has brought about these changes, because with the direct listing before, you had you can basically bid and do all this stuff online. And so it's very easy for the company to conduct a direct listing. In the old days, it would have been like phone calls and stuff. So I think technology is part of why direct listings have taken off. And then also this retail access, that's also been simplified by technology. Robinhood, basically, you're on the app, you click, yes, I want some shares. Boom. Yeah. They know who wants them, how many, and then they decide who gets shares and how many.
Yeah, the landscape is changing so dramatically, and I know we've talked about it on the pods a lot. Obviously, we are products of FinTwit, the financial Twitter, but clearly everything in terms of access to information, analysis, you're listening to this pod completely free. Our hot takes, 10 years ago, you weren't getting this same sort of access. No way. And now you're going to get that same sort of access on the IPOs. It's making the playing field much more level. You know what? Following music, right, Scott? Like, there was a big revolution in music, call it like 10, 15 years ago, right? When the recording software, right? Like, all of this stuff just became far more accessible, right?
Yeah, anyone can make pro quality music, and anyone can DJ now. And
Yeah, people are like, well, it's going to ruin the music. I'm like, no, it's not going to ruin the music. In fact, it's going to make everything better. And in fact, it all got better. Now, obviously, royalties and all the rest, I'm not going to say this is an entire Band-Aid for what, the ails in the music industry. But in terms of the access to creative minds to do things that they never could before because they didn't have the rig or whatever, profound.
Yeah, and I would say this has happened in investing now, where the information that a professional investor is getting, that same information is available to someone who just started investing yesterday. And so that's a game changer.
Exactly.
You got to utilize it. I mean, it's not just going to be fed to you. Like, you still have to know how to use it. But now you can make as informed decisions as the pros who get paid millions of dollars to do that.
Well, yeah, and I think the other side is this whole veil of these guys, like, active management has been shown to, especially boomer active management. I'll be very clear about that. Boomer active management, has just been a total dog. These guys are getting paid a lot of money. And I think, smart boomers are saying, hey, listen, what am I paying for here? You got wonder kinds like Kathy Wood, and I know there's controversial ears, et cetera. But bottom line is, there's a lot of different takes on how how you can manage your money, access to it is so different. And the people that are Grizzle's one of them, right? Like, there are different camps. You're listening to the pod because you kind of you vibe with what we're talking about and how we invest. And and thank you for being part of that audience.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
Yeah, totally. And, I just think of it no different than, asset management is going to be very much like band, Scott. You know what I mean? You're like, yeah, I listen to the Grizzle guys. I got that record. Oh, yeah, you listen to those guys too. You know what I mean? Like, everyone's going to be kind of a band, and it's cool. It's as opposed to like, yeah, I've got two funds. One's in Templeton and one's in
here.
I'm
with Morgan Stanley.
Yeah, just like, who cares? Like, you're you're hearing it. It's authentic because the people are out there on Twitter grinding, showing you what they're thinking, right? This whole that previous way is just so done. I know it's fascinating. Well, the other thing I was going to say, I just thought I'd just throw in my two cents on this one, Scott, is that same thing happened in music has happened to TV recording, movies, etc., with YouTube, right? The access has just been totally democratized.
Yeah, and access to equipment too, how cheap 4K cameras have gotten and editing software. And so anyone can make a really high quality looking movie. You just see these amateur filmmakers making legit stuff now.
Yeah, totally.
Which is great for the consumer. Basically, it's all great for the consumer. When costs are coming down and you're getting cheaper access to better content, boom, winner.
Yeah. Oh, Scott, so as retail gets more access to IPOs, I think it's a great, huge new thing, and I think it'll be awesome. And that'll add to the value of what we bring, right, Scott? Because, like, we're doing IPO research, and all we can, when we do that work, Scott, it's always like, well, guys, this is what we ultimately think the value is. It's going to pop, do its whatever. But now you can really identify, get your bid in, because you're going to get part of that pop, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Right, you're not leaving it. You yourself aren't leaving any money on the table as a retail investor. So that I think that's powerful. The other aspect too, Scott, that I think will be an evolution too. So now you're getting retail having access to IPOs. I think as you think through time, retail is going to demand more and more pieces of private deals, venture deals, on a risk-adjusted basis, of course, and in a weighting in their overall portfolio that makes a ton of sense because, returns are just hard to come by. Yields are like freaking negative, right?
At the end of the day, though, there's more than enough demand in the private markets for like most of these deals going public. So it's like, why would retail just get access just because? In the old days, you had to like call around and get to know people and maybe do something for them. And then they give you some shares. So I'm wondering there has to be some really good positive from giving retail access earlier on, because there's already more than enough institutional demand to fill up most of these deals.
Yeah, I don't know. So I think it just generally just the evolution, Scott. Like, I think that whole old school gated, if you just even think what's happened on the trading side, the old relationships, it's all just been just very compartmentalized, just everything's just been driven down to their most like just efficient piece and matter, right? If you think about it, now when you think about how trading desks are run versus the past, you're not going out with the traders and grabbing beers. It's a bunch of computers that are connecting all the orders. And now when you want to pay for research, Europe, right? MiFID, right? They're changing how they're doing that. You just direct
it's making
the money,
everything more efficient, which ultimately increases transparency, and then pricing comes down. Good for investors.
Exactly.
But what I want to see with this retail access, so with Robinhood, it seemed like it was more of a Robinhood used it to make sure they filled the deal than it was like retail was really getting special access this time. And I hope it doesn't continue where that's what companies use it. It's like, say a deal isn't very popular and then they say, oh, retail, you can get access at the last minute and fill it with them. I don't want it to work like that, because then retail is getting the bad deals only when it should be just getting access to IPOs in general.
Right. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I think Robinhood was going out with the view early on that they were going to include retail in this, right? You were telling us that,
yeah.
Right?
Basically, coming from the opinion that it looked like they were kind of just filling loose supply with retail was because they said they were going to do about 30% retail. They ended up at 20 and they could have done anything. So that just makes me think they went to the institution guys and they said, do you want this? Once those guys all bought as much as they wanted, then they went to retail and just filled the rest. I hope I'm wrong, but just because they ended up filling so much less than they said they were, that's the gist I got from it.
So here's my kind of slightly different take on that, where I think they had a band. So they could go as high as 30 and then they wouldn't go below 20 because then optically wouldn't look good, right? You say first you're going to do 30 and then you kind of go do 10 and that wouldn't look good. But I think ultimately it works out. It's with respect to pricing, right? Because institutional is what guides pricing.
Yeah. So I think that plays the same thing. So they came out at 42 originally for the IPO and it ended up pricing at 38. And so maybe institutions were saying after this regulatory stuff's coming out, FINRA's looking at you some more, I'll pay 34. And they said, no, because retail is going to pay 38. So we'd rather let them in on the deal. So that's still not good for retail, though.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, the interplay. But, very rarely, I think one interesting part about it is, right, I initially, the view typically, as we've seen post IPOs, is that it starts at 42 and it grinds higher. This one didn't, Scott.
Amount of media coverage, that's unprecedented. Because every other IPO, we've been covering them at Grizzle in depth for like 3 years. Whenever they have this much media coverage, it either crashes and burns like WeWork, or it has a huge pop. So this got out the door, but it did not pump at all.
So it's kind of interesting, right? So typically where you first start pricing, it'll kind of go a few bucks higher, maybe another $7 higher, whatever, right? It'll go maybe 10% higher, right? So you start at 42, then you maybe get to like 40, 46, 47. Yeah. This went from 42 back to 38. Like, that was not a good indicator for Robinhood.
No. But their first pricing, I guess, was somewhat near where they ended up. So that's good. They read the market well. They got out at a similar price. It was actually the range they started with. It was 38 to 42 is the range.
Right. And so you want to talk about that specifically. So it IPO. So institutional and retail got it for $38. And then the first trade was at 42. That's what you're talking about, right?
Well, what I'm saying is when they first priced it privately before it was set in stone, the range was 38 to 42.
Right.
And then then it ended up finally pricing the night before it went public at 38. So it was within the range they originally set.
Yeah.
So it shows they kind of read the market correctly, however it worked out. But just to explain to you guys the IPO process, they have some preliminary conversations with these big institutions. And then the guys are like, well, I'll pay 38. I'll pay 42. They come up with the range, but those guys haven't put any money on the table. Then the next few days, they actually get orders, and that's when they update the round. You know, if there's tons of people that want in at 42, well, maybe they can demand 46 or 50.
Yeah. So it looks like the first trade on this thing came out at like 40 or something.
Yeah,
like
and then that, it immediately kind of went down to 38 and then was down 10% on the day, I guess.
Yeah, I saw that the first trade was high, and then it just kind of fell. It just fell like hammers right after that.
I bet that's always the case. Like the way they price, you know, they decide when it starts trading that day. And there's a lot of like they can mess with it. So maybe the first trade of the day could usually be the same as the pricing or higher. But then the market takes over and go where it's going to go.
And so what was historic about this one is an IPO of this size has now not fallen this much post the IPO.
Yeah. So, I mean, Tom and I before the pod were trying to figure out, we each had an opinion on why this IPO did not do well. And, you know, I was saying partly it could be because there's so many retail investors, and retail investors may know the company less well than some big institutions. So I was thinking, well, if they see weakness in the early trading, maybe they're just like, I don't really know why I own this, I'm going to sell. But Tom, what was your counter argument to that?
Yeah, no, you know, I think like the reality is I know a lot of institutions have paper hands, like, you know, they're built with paper.
And we
hands,
just
right?
talked
you
about know, they like, want they don't want to hold. They want that day one pop. And that's part of their business model. They always will sell right away.
Yeah. So I think to think maybe retail is as paper hands or more paper hands than institution, I think is like giving way too much credit to institution. I think like most IPO, there are a lot of IPO holders that are just in there for the whole, like, listen, I can pass this along. I think secondarily, you know, just the unloved nature. There's a lot of schmucks in khakis and you know, polo tees, you know, the Wall Street kind of old PM vibe that felt like, hey, listen, this is a cool kids IPO, you know, and they thought that this thing would get bid. But, my view is that they didn't understand how loathed. So the retail who didn't get an allocation, i.e. the retail outside that was going to potentially lift this stock up.
And that's what you need, right? Because the guys who got allocations already got their fill. It's unlikely they buy more, but you need retail investors to buy from those institutions to drive up the stock on day one.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, this, you know, just Vlad and all that went down with GameStop, you know, just was an unloved unloved CEO. Let's be frank, you know, and they kind of did like a full court press to like, you know, image him up.
To be fair, it seemed like they saved themselves and brought some losses onto investors. And they'll argue all day that was not the case. They were safeguarding investors, but people like Dave Portnoy, who's a big personality, he got locked out of trading GameStop. And so he may have lost some money because he seems pretty sour about it. We know other people did as well. So I think a lot of these retail investors haven't forgotten. That was still fresh.
No, for sure. And I think that whole idea, the idea of Robinhood always saying we're democratizing finance, and the one time you get to show it, and just like, you know, they, you know, with GameStop, they ended up, whether it's their own capital requirements or not, but the reality is who it helped was the hedge funds.
Yeah, their risk management wasn't good, and then their customers suffered for it.
Yeah, so just kind of, at the end of the day, the interface may change, and maybe on your phone, and it seems like everyone's got more access, but, you know, when push comes to shove, it's Wall Street, same old Wall Street.
But so what we're getting at is we're trying to figure out why, what was the driver behind Robinhood being down on the first day? Because it was kind of historic. And so unfortunately for me, I'd love to say it was just because there's more retail investors and they got spooked or whatever it is. But because it was also not a loved stock, the management team had kind of burned investors. We will never know. It could be a mix of both. Yeah. It could just be it was hated. You know, it could be a lot of different things. But the problem there is I'd love to know if the retail component really made a difference in the pricing, because that'll determine if IPOs in the future do let retail investors in. Because as I said, before this Robinhood IPO, retail investors were only 1% at the max of an IPO shares. Now they're 20. Yep. So if this had gone really well, you could say that other companies may start to really let retail investors in. Now I'm not so sure, because the stock price did go down.
Yeah. And I take the other side of that. And I think this was a unique scenario where, a lot of people are learning that, irrespective of, numbers looking great, et cetera, for the business itself, an unloved CEO, an unloved company per se, like it's, and you're relying on retail to carry the ball, sometimes you just read the market wrong. Right. And I think that's what's happened. That perspective. And I think there are going to be a ton of great IPOs. Like, I think Roblox is a great example, Scott. If you allowed retail to participate in that, I thought that would be bonkers, right? Yeah. Like, I think the pricing initially would have been higher. I think the stock itself would be high. Like, all of those things, like something where, people are like, yeah, this is like, I'm involved. The best CEO is the one you don't even think about. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even know who the Roblox CEO is. That's great, man. Yeah. But things got a little tense here. Good for Robinhood to get the, they themselves, I didn't think they were going to get an IPO done this year.
And they needed it. I'm sure there was all this stuff related to stock options and what they promised. And they got all these loans earlier in the year that probably said, if you don't go public, these bad things happen to us, and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, like So, good for the management team for pulling this thing off. Like, listen, we weren't buying, but I would have never thought they would have gotten it done. But to your point, Scott, they probably just needed the money, right? So,
that retail access, it basically was a traditional IPO with a direct listing on top. So they named their price to retail. They said, take it or leave it. It's 38. And then retail's enough of them said yes. And so that's how that's how direct listings work, is just people submit shares and price. This was kind of the same, but they set the price and then people submitted shares.
Yeah.
So it was a hybrid.
That's right. Yeah. So this is fascinating. You know what? And so that's the IPO disrupted. Scott, we had Robinhood, and then we had, which was not a great IPO, but then we had Traeger.
Yeah, traditional solid IPO. So Traeger does grills for the 1%, is how I like to say it. It's wood pellet. And so it basically, you can cook from your phone. You just say, cook the food, and it does it. So that, for me, that takes some of the fun out of it, but it's catching on like wildfire among people who like to grill. So that stock was up 25% from the IPO price, and it priced above the initial range. So that's overall a successful IPO. Why is this interesting is because Weber, the big bad grill company that's kind of a main competitor to Traeger, is going public next week. So we're going to have a lot of content on that, helping you guys compare and contrast these two companies and deciding which one of the two you should own, maybe both, maybe none.
Yeah, kind of interesting. Like Traeger is like far more the kind of like hipsterish or whatever.
When you see an iPhone on the commercial for a grill, you know what you're getting, versus it's not a Weber that you take on a camping trip.
Yeah, like this is kind of like, Traeger is really, Traeger is by definition showcases the flex and the power of influencers, specifically Joe Rogan. That's a Joe Rogan story. obviously, you know, a company that's, you know, a great grill, et cetera. But, you know, you go, I was talking to a Traeger guy at Costco. It's a cult, man, all this stuff. It's just like, you know, ultimately I got in. I'm like, holy cow. He's like explaining it all. And you're like, oh, like, this is really cool. You know, like they kind of romance you into the whole story. You're like, yeah, of course I see myself purchasing pellets for the rest of my life. I don't, Scott.
But,
really,
but investors love that type of thing. So we'll help you guys understand better, because Traeger uses pellets. You can't just grab whatever wood you want. And they're the main seller of pellets. I think you can get it other places, but they have 96% of people who buy Traeger grills buy Traeger pellets, they said. And that's a consumable. I dug into it a bit. You burn like 2 pounds of pellets every hour you want to smoke something, and it's $1 per pound of pellets. So you just factor that into your grill. But I mean, charcoal costs money too, so it's kind of all the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's a different kind of take, but
so Traeger is really interesting because they have a tech component. Usually grills don't have that. And then Weber is going to say they have a tech component, but really Weber's just the, you know, every price point for everyone.
Yeah. Interesting. And it's just like, you know, we'll talk about it more.
Yeah. I'm doing a deep dive right now. And so look out for more on our social channels. We're going to have some entertaining and some informative videos out on both of these guys.
Yeah, totally. And it goes to show, you know, obviously, Traeger, we'd highlighted it on Twitter and stuff. It was interesting. I just wanted one that, you know, it's always when you have a big debut IPO and you have a number two, Scott, always the one that's like the undercard is always the one that pops. You know, the one that like is not like the big, like getting the big media spotlight, right?
And you know, going
like,
first helps too. If you wanted to invest in a grill IPO, you maybe shot your bullet on the first one and now you don't have any left.
That's right. And do you remember Compass Pathways? I think there was like 3 IPOs that day, and Compass was the one that was standing tall.
Yeah, because I remember it was Snowflake and then another big one. Yeah. And Snowflake got all the media coverage, Compass almost none. And then Compass was the best performing by far.
And that was our topic.
Yeah. That's what you got to look for. If you're going to play IPOs, in general, you underperform versus only in the hottest markets do IPOs outperform other stocks. But if you find the unloved, unfollowed IPOs, there's a better chance they'll do okay than the hottest 100%. Of the hot IPOs. All right, so that was one other IPO just to mention. And then we got to talk about Pinterest because they had earnings this weekend. That was probably one of the biggest movers, I think, from earnings. We saw more beats than misses, but Pinterest was a big miss.
Yeah, down like 19%. That's big moves.
Yeah, that's
like
real big.
For a big tech stock, you know, that's like foundational shift in the company.
Yeah, that's like everything that investors had built in, they had to change their expectations. And then adjust the positions accordingly.
Yeah, you know, I'll be honest, from a tech perspective and just, you know, thinking back to, you know, the O2 bubble and that sort of thing, you know, stocks down 20% is not a good thing, Scott. Amazon's down 7%. And I'm not saying this is, you know, ushering a new bear market, but this is just, it's showing you how things get frothy in.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing. It tells you that valuations are frothy because if a price to sales multiple is 50, why can't it go to 45? Why can't it go to 30? Right. And so I think as time goes on, you see bigger moves around earnings misses and beats as the market gets hotter. And so you're seeing
now. Like, and yeah, you're kind of in today's a rough day everything's kind of red today, but you know, I keep using ARK as a barometer, Scott, just because it's kind of, you know, we talk about it because they're so far, like, you know, they're investing in all the things that have 50, 100 times price to sales. So Pinterest is down like 19%. ARK is down 1.5%. You know, the S&P 500 is down 0.5%. So that kind of leverage, right?
Yeah, so three X leverage on ARK. Sometimes more. Certain days I've seen it down 5 or so.
Yeah, totally. And so, you know, it just shows you that, you know, once you to your point, Scott, once you start to spook this whole, well, you know, was what was happening at Pins this this profound on a fundamental level? I don't think so, to be down 20%, but what it's translating to is the fact is your valuation was wrong.
Yeah, so what's going to happen here is the estimate for sales next year is not going to fall 20%. That's not what's happening. So that means that the multiple of sales is what really took a hit here. And that happens when stocks are expensive. You don't have that support, fundamental support as much.
You got that graph that compares all the...
Yeah, so I got a nice Y charts graph. This is what we use a lot. It's the price to sales ratio using forecasted results for Pinterest.
Yeah.
And so there's basically with Pinterest, there's three other companies you comp it against: Twitter, Snap, and Facebook. And, you know, Pinterest had a nice run starting in August of 2020 when they really started to monetize. The whole thing was Pinterest was very early in making money off their customers, but the growth was good. So everyone was like, man, they have a lot of opportunity to make money. They started ramping that up internationally in the US. Stock really ran. So now what ended up happening this earnings season is their growth disappointed in the US, and that's their major market. So growth disappointments, when you're very expensive stock, market does not like that. So they were at, it looks like about 13, 14 times price to sales. That was close to Snap. So among this group, you have price to sales between 7 and 20. And Facebook's low end. So now with this sell-off, Pinterest was at 13. They're all the way back down to 11. Twitter, which has been doing okay lately, is up to 9. So getting closer to a Twitter than a best of breed Snap at this point.
Yeah. It's and you know, typically when I see stocks down 20%, my first reaction is, Scott, should we be buying leap calls? Like, should I be getting like just some leverage into some normalization here? And then what I immediately did was then, okay, well, let me see. Like, I don't follow pins as closely, Scott, that, you know, that's Scott's wheelbarrow. But then I just go into Y charts and just like, okay, let me just graph the fundamentals. This is a graph that I pulled out. And I was like, man, you know, it'd be one thing if it was like cheaper than
yeah,
than
now it's Twitter just not stuff, as you know? Expensive. That's
yeah,
not the best.
You know, and
you don't know if they're going to have another quarter of weaker growth and then work through it. Like, they still have a lot of opportunity to make a lot of money off people. They are monetizing much less than Pinterest, even Twitter and Facebook, because they started later. So that's okay. That's a positive here. But I don't know that there's not going to be continuation when it sells off 20%. Because like in the next month, what are they going to put out that's going to stem the doubt among investors? Yep, but I like that. I just say if you're going to buy, you don't want to put your whole position in of what you'd want to own. You put in some, see if it keeps going down. If it rebounds, you say, okay, we put in a bottom. And same with options. Yep. That's the problem. Options are more expensive. You might not be able to buy many of those. Yep. But that can make sense. Because as we said, if you go long-term option, we're not talking short-term. This is like a two-year option. Yeah, yeah. You can, if the stock goes up 20%, you can make 100%.
So Pinterest, and just to distill the business model there, which I do like, it's that idea, you know, they've basically categorized the whole picture space, right? It's got like more or less, right? If there's something like, if you're trying to remodel your kitchen, your living room, you know, you're looking for ideas, you know, it's a flow through from the visual picture.
Yeah. Their bread and butter is women, with events. You're redoing your house or you have a wedding or something like that. That's really how they started. Right. And they've been trying to get into, more men's stuff and shopping, and shopping's big too. And so they tout their technology that they're going to go into everything. The big positive for them is when you go on Pinterest, you're looking to buy something. So those users are much closer to a purchase than a lot of other social media platforms. So that could be powerful for them longer term. They're still trying to figure out, remember, monetization, they're still learning, just like a Twitter is. And so they have a lot of room to do it, but they're not doing it well yet compared to like a Facebook.
Yeah, you know, I was on pins actually this week, and I was looking for, you know, to paint for a room and, you know, just different design ideas. And, you know, and I was like, well, you know, how is Bear Paints, you know, basically promoting on Pinterest and that sort of thing? Like, you know, you got to see things like that, right? How it all works. And, you know, you can see how that ecosystem can work for sure.
I could see augmented reality being pretty powerful. Like, what if you had a wall and you could put your phone up to the wall and it would show the different colors through Pinterest and be bear or buy right here? Or, I mean, everyone's going to be trying to do that stuff. But so I wouldn't count Pinterest out. This isn't like the model's broken, but it is concerning that US growth is slowing. It's okay for it not really to be growing. Like Twitter and Snap, US is not really growing, but it's not going down.
No, for sure.
So it looks like Pinterest got a little bit of a COVID bump and now it's coming off.
Yeah. So one to watch. Valuation still not as compelling yet, but I think we've highlighted some interesting aspects of the model. Yeah.
Okay. Next, we got to talk about China a little bit because they have been making headlines. the government has come out, cracked down a lot of different tech companies. I don't know if is there a chart you want to show, Tom, or you just kind of want to give your take?
Well,
on
you know,
it?
Why don't we like you know maybe we'll talk. There are a couple charts, but why don't we talk first, Scott? We'll talk about just what's going down. It started with Didi. That's their like rideshare program, yeah, right?
China's so, like, Uber, basically.
China's Uber. And what happened there? That was basically they just said no new downloads. Like they took it off the app store.
Yeah, they
right?
kicked more them off the Chinese app store. So it's hard to do business if you're not. I mean, people who already had the app could use it. I believe they're still offering rides. It's just there's no new users. If you delete the app, you can't get it back. Stuff like that. So it's thrown quite a wrench in a company that just went public a few weeks ago in the U.S.
Yeah, that was a pretty big smackdown. So that was like literally went public. Then they dropped this thing. It just you know almost felt like a slap in the face to U.S. investors. Maybe it was intended. So who knows? But then the follow up was then these learning companies, like you know there's a ton of these Chinese learning companies that are public in America through ADRs. Then the Chinese government's talking about taking all of that.
Nonprofit. You have to be a nonprofit now, right? You can't be for profit.
Yeah, and so that just basically like those stocks were down like 70% on the hop.
And then they went after Tencent, which was one of the biggest tech companies in China, and said you can't sign up any new customers for a bit. You got to change some things. So they just So I guess there's some big changes afoot, and they're just going after everyone at once, saying you know fix this, fix that, can't do that anymore.
Oh man, it's just like, you know, and so in the latest here, I'll just read a quick headline here. So Bloomberg, Beijing pressed ahead with moves to assert greater control over technology companies, continuing a campaign that rolled financial markets and prompted Washington to suspend public offerings by Chinese companies on U.S. exchanges until risks are better disclosed. So now we got to, you know, no more Chinese IPOs, right? This is the great wall, the great IPO wall now. It's going down, right? So this is.
So is this a falling knife, Tom, or are you buyer after the bloodbath?
Yeah. So you know, Scott, get my tweet. I think that tweet. If you pull that tweet up, I think it succinctly states how I feel here. Let me get it as well, because I think this is.
There we go.
So basically, this is the way I see it, right? So technology is basically the bedrock of markets right now. Like Scott and I are covering technology all the time because why, Scott? They're great companies,
yeah,
right?
They make a lot of money and they're growing fast.
Totally. So high ROEs in the stock market are found in technology. Fact. Second, if you're getting a really high ROE, chances are you're in an oligopoly.
Yeah.
Basically,
And for everyone out there, ROE is return on equity.
Exactly. Yeah. So high returns on equity are found in tech. Fact. Then the second is, well, how you get those higher ROEs is the fact that you've become an oligopoly. And we're going to talk a little bit about.
If you're an oligopoly, so you got to pretend you're not one. Right.
Exactly. Right. And so but, you know, by virtue, the way it works in terms of, you know, just everyone coming to your platform, that's just the way it works. Right. Tech has that what's that called, Scott? You know, everything.
Ecosystem.
Ecosystem where it brings everyone together. And so the bottom line is oligopolies, the concentration of power, economic power, this is incompatible with the Communist Party of China. Just it is.
Because they don't want anyone to have power but them.
No, exactly. Like when you think about North America, it's not the politicians that are in control. It's our social media platforms. Right? It's the Facebooks. It's what Google allows. You know, like it's Twitter.
Yeah, they
right?
control you know what we see of what the politicians are saying. So they got to control the politicians in a way.
Oh, hugely. Like, so Scott, I will tell you this for a fact. I was a follower of Donald Trump just because entertainment, he was the president. Since they kicked him off, the number of times you and I talk about Donald Trump, zero.
Yeah, we used to talk right? to him about him once a day, and now it's zero.
Now it's gone to zero. Yeah. Literally the power you get to kick someone off a platform. So basically it's simple as this, right? When oligopolies are incompatible with the Chinese Communist Party, tech is basically oligopolies. That's just the way you got to think about it. If you're going to invest in the best tech companies, by definition, they have a DNA that's oligopolistic. So it's as simple as that. So, you know, the only lifeline that I see for China right now, the road they're going right now, I'm so will confirm I am not a buyer of the dip. This is troubling stuff. I'd say the only lifeline for Chinese tech companies is to pay out their high cash flows. Like, if you're generating genuinely true high cash flows, Scott, then you have to pay it out as dividends. Give me a reason to want to put my money in a Baba or whatever.
Yeah, so you're kind of speaking to enticing in international investors again, right? Because like international investors are realizing again, the government still runs that economy. It's not a capitalist, 100% capitalist. So if I get cash coming in my pocket from owning an Alibaba or something, I might be more incentivized to still own it, even with all these risks around the government clamping down.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so the way I think, very simply put, as these companies earn lots of profit, it stays on their balance sheet, it stays within the company. More of that money that stays within the company, if they are an oligopoly and they're in tech, which by definition, that's how it all works, then they become a risk. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So bottom line is distribute the money and then the money's not at risk from getting taken away.
I think going a bit further to what the government was unhappy about is some of the data collection practices of these companies. For one, Didi tracks, where everyone's traveling from to when, what time, who they're meeting with, that type of thing. And so I think the government wants them to collect that in a certain way, store it in a certain way, and they might have maybe not really listened. That's what the rumor is. So the government now is saying, you got to change how you do these things to how we want it to be. Then we'll let you operate again.
Right, same with Tencent.
Yeah. Something to do with their data collection, data management.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's just a ton of risk. And I know there's a lot of dip buyers out there just saying, hey, this is what, when blood's on the street, this is what you do. Well, I'm not so certain about that. We just did a quick interview. If you go on my Twitter, you can see it. I'll throw it up on LinkedIn as well with Perth Toll. Fantastic. She has created a freedom index, Scott. This is, we got the graph up right now, right?
So we have performance of her ETF versus the Golden Dragon China ETF, which is, that's just stocks that trade in China, right?
No. So that's Chinese stocks that trade in America.
Oh, only the ones that trade in America.
Yeah. It's a great.
Yeah,
it's American depository receipts,
they're called.
Exactly. So basically, let me tell you a little bit about her ETF and why I think it's interesting. We did a quick 2-minute clip. It's a good one. Watch it. She gives a really solid take on what's going down in China and why you don't buy the dip here and why freedom wins. Freedom wins, right? Human freedom, capital freedom, all this sort of thing. So basically, what she does in her index is they've got like a freedom weighted index. So basically, the more free you are, the higher weighting you have, and the less free, you just aren't in the index. So her emerging market index is X China, X India, right? And so there are there are reasons for both. We've done a longer interview with her. You can hear it there. But bottom line is, you look in the last year, this is powerful stuff. It's emerging market index is up 28%. While the Invesco Golden Dragon China ETF, which is basically an ETF of Chinese stocks that are just trading in America. So these are the educational companies. This is your DD, whatever.
Your Alibaba.
Right? It's down. Yeah. It's down 6.5% over the last year, which is,
And it was outperforming by 50% at one point this year.
Yeah. So it was up as high as 70. I want to say that looks like it's close to like 70%. It was up as high as 70%. Mm-hmm. And now it's giving it all back.
Yeah. So it looks like, her ETF is slow and steady, putting up some good numbers. You don't have to deal with the volatility of owning Chinese stocks.
And I think that's the big thing, right? I think another aspect of that is just translating is that, you take away volatility and, it's you're just taking away these outcomes that are uncontrolled. And that's what adds volatility to a market, to a stock.
Yeah. And the reason volatility is bad is it makes you do dumb things. That's why. Yeah. Like you might say, oh, it's volatile. Who cares? It outperformed. But were you there to see it outperform because it was down 30% at one point? You panicked. That's why volatility is a problem.
Now it's volatility, especially in high risk growth stuff, tricky stuff.
We're to our last topic. We got it. This is hot off the press. Some tweets from Elon Musk. I guess he's not eating lunch. He's very hungry right now, but he had to get his tweet out before he ate his egg salad sandwich.
What do we got here?
So let me read you the tweet here. he's saying. Apple App Store fees are a de facto global tax on the internet. Epic is right. And what he means by Epic is Epic, the video game maker, is in a big lawsuit with Apple saying, you can't charge us these fees. These are crazy. So he's siding with them. So, Tom, do you...
Could you talk about what the fees are, Scott? Just because I'm new to this, so understanding who is Epic. Epic is a video game maker.
Epic,
right?
Makes Fortnite, which is I think one of the most popular massive multiplayer games. I mean, if you have any kid who's over like seven, they're playing it probably. And what happened is Apple charges 30% of any revenue you make if you're on the Apple App Store. And this includes for purchases made in-game. So what Epic was doing is if you're playing, you download the Epic app for Fortnite, and then you say you buy a costume. That dollar you spend on the costume, Apple gets 30%. And Epic was saying, no, it's in our game. It's not part of the App Store. We don't have to give you 30. And Apple's like, no, you do. So that's what they're fighting about, because they were doing a workaround where they weren't having to pay that 30% fee, but everyone pays the 30% fee. And so I think for me, this kind of falls on deaf ears, because Apple's a free market company. You don't have to be on the App Store. You don't have to make apps for the App Store. If you don't want to pay the 30%, go to Google, go to Android. So he's just arguing that Apple is a powerful company and people like using the App Store, so they have a lot of power. It's not a tax on the entire internet, right? It's being a little dramatic. I don't know. What's your take, Tom?
I got to take those. I just feel that this is just like 30% feels egregious, right? The pricing is everything, right? And I think, like, look at what Twitter's doing for spaces. You could sell tickets. I think they're taking like 3%, and that's arguably too low, right? You know what I mean? Like there's a pricing that's, I think, fair, and it doesn't...
30% feels like Ticketmaster. Like I'm going to a concert.
Feels bad.
But that just shows you how much power Apple has. So I don't disagree with you. 30% is definitely too high, but they've been able to keep it like that for way too long. And I think what happened is... Everyone, if you said anything about it, they probably would cut you off from the App Store. So everyone was silent. Now people are starting to raise their voices about this 30%. And if they give a deal, they know if they give a deal to one company, everyone else wants a deal. So this is now everyone starting to complain about 30%. They're going to chip away at it. That's coming down.
Yeah. And this is like, this is that classic, if you're an oligopoly, which they are, in the sense that, okay, so there's Apple and then there's Android, right? Let's be frank. Like, I'm not like, I don't think there's any other. So let's call it a spade. It's an oligopoly. I think you're right. Obviously it's their tech, it's their hardware, it's the quality of their software that makes me want to buy
the variety of apps you can find.
Yeah. And so, got it all. But now I'm on this ecosystem. And the real question is, from here, how do I, of course, this is all residual of me, Apple, building all of this. And, you just have a privilege to be, in this ecosystem and take what you can. Or second, you're just now you're so big and you understand regulators are looking at you saying, whoa, you guys are right in the, you're basically a, what's that called? You're a pathway for, for economic activity now. Right. And so you've got something to do here where you've got 30%. That's like, to your point, that sounds like Ticketmaster, not like like a Visa fee. Yeah. Let's use Visa fees or whatever. Yeah. Right. And I know a lot of retailers, small retailers, really, the Visa fees are very high too. Right. But this is insanity. Right. And I think if, panning back, Scott, I think there is a tactical error that Apple made here in keeping the fees at 30%. Cause it's now like, now they're kind of in this weird space where they're going to have to walk these fees back, but it's why the hell were they 30% in the first place?
Because they could, and no one could argue less. So now they got 30% for 10, 15 years. Now it's going to go down, but they'll fight the fight, keep it as high as possible, I guess.
Yeah.
So I don't know if customers aren't really complaining because we don't pay the fee. It's like embedded. So, an app that might have been a dollar, say they pay 30%, maybe they make it $1.30 for us. So it's kind of like hidden a little bit. It's when you start creating apps that you get mad about it.
What's the right premium then? Like 10%?
20%. Yeah, 10 sounds okay, because I mean, Visa's, 10. Like 3, isn't it? So maybe if it's something like apps at 10.
Sure as hell ain't 3 versus 30.
No, 30's, man. Yeah, that's too much. So, yeah, but that's I wonder why Elon's doing that. Because I was thinking, like, he doesn't work with Apple really. Like, he doesn't need their chips for his cars. I just wonder if, you know, there's kind of a chip shortage. Did they just grab a bunch of chips and he couldn't get any? And now he's just pissed, so he tweets that.
Yeah, I think he's just good at the game, right? He kind of just sees an opportunity to, like, pop.
It felt a little too quiet in his feed, so he's like, I got to poke someone.
Yeah, and, you know, and he's kind of like, you know, I think he was coming off. So here's my own personal view, fanboys, fangirls, whatever. That's kind of Elon's whole thing. He had a huge fanboy, fangirl base. And then the whole Bitcoin thing disrupted that narrative, and he didn't like to be the bad guy, right? And then he did the B word thing. He's trying to mend fences.
Yeah,
Scott.
You're probably very smart. Yeah, that is.
And this is a populist thing to say, and everyone's gonna rally around Elon. Like, I saw this and I'm like, I'm no fanboy of Elon, but I'm like, this looks like the right take, Scott.
Something he knew almost everyone but Tim Cook would agree with him on.
Totally. And I'm like, hey, listen, if he can kind of, you know, slowly build back fanboy base, stay Bitcoin, all that sort of thing, it's kind of, you know, stay in his wheelhouse, if you will. And I think that's kind of, I don't know, I think he's slowly trying to build back his fan base, if you will.
This makes me think it must be kind of strange working in some of these big tech companies when you know exactly what they do and some of the, like, not so great parts of it, how you feel about it. You're like, oh, I'm building this, and you know, my friend didn't have a good experience because of this thing I built. It must be kind of strange, you know? You're like, I love people I'm working with. I love what I'm doing here, but, like, I don't like the outcome sometimes.
Well, yeah, and let's be frank. Like, you know, we were talking about this a bit before too, right? I think inherent, right, with cheap money, free money, and all that's going down right now, it's you're getting so many people building things for free and hoping to monetize later that they're – even with Apple doing this egregious thing here, Scott, and you may be an engineer there, maybe then you go start a thing and give something away for free and hope to monetize it later. But chances are it doesn't go anywhere, and then you've given everyone deflation. On that thing.
Dude, I just thought of something. What if recession is actually bad for inflation? Because think about, tech has been such a big part of the deflation story because all our chips are getting cheaper. Everyone who is saying I'll monetize later, they say I got to monetize now. Price of all your tech goes up in a recession.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to have to watch for that.
You know, that's a great point, right? So, you know, you know, we take the view that we'll talk about it. Actually, we'll save it for the next pod because this has been a great pod in terms of just going through topics. But tech has been the singular biggest source of deflation in the world. Like, it's keeping everything kind of cozy.
I think I saw a CPI chart that showed that tech's down 20% in price. Well, things like education are up more than 100%, grains, all that normal stuff.
Scott, let's just talk about this quickly. You're using OBS software. How much is that costing you?
Quick. Zero. How much has it ever costed me? Zero.
I dialed into this for Scott to patch me in. I look kind of high defy. My sound sounds good. I'm coming through Skype. You know how much I had to pay? Zero. So we're producing high quality video feed.
High fidelity, high quality.
Everything. It's going to get sent to podcast, and all of this has cost us $0.
Yeah, and I remember when Skype used to charge money, and then they just stopped. And so that's happened with lots of tech products.
Exactly. And I'm still – so what's the story behind – anyways, it's getting off topic. But all this masterful production, if you're ever considering pod or doing videos, everything we do, Scott has turned into the wonder kid for this stuff. This is OBS. Scott, what's the background in OBS and why is it for free? I don't know. I think you mentioned it to me a long time ago.
I think there's just a lot of open source technology now out there in codes, and so someone decided to, out of the kindness of their heart, make this thing because they probably needed it, and then other people contributed to it. There's always new plugins being made, and it's just become the de facto streaming software, probably because who was first streaming video games? It was kids with no money. OBS is free. We'll all use OBS. There's another one called Streamlabs OBS, which is very confusing. I think that one's more expensive, but it does more things off the shelf. You don't have to teach yourself, but, like, everyone uses OBS. So it's just, you see that with a lot of stuff in tech now. People are willing to share the code and improve it for free.
That's wild, right? So that, like, just to show you the basically the foundational going live streaming videos interface production software is basically shareware.
Yeah. Free. Yeah. I was so surprised. Just and it, they're always updating it too. It's always improving, and no one's charging you a cent.
Goodness of the internet. Yeah.
But that's this is a good topic for another day too. If I'm sure you guys will be talking about inflation sooner than later, so we can, you know, dive deeper into this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, man, great pod. Always stuff going down, guys. We'll see you. Things to watch out for. Yeah, guys, we got the Traeger thing. Traeger versus
Weber IPO. Some content next week. More earnings, more tech earnings.
We'll keep you posted. Yeah. Keep it all coming down.
Yeah. That was Grizzle Pod, episode 22. See you later, everyone.